Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. And welcome to part two of this week's Duel of the Detectives. On Monday's episode, Jack Nicholson snooping got him into a whole world of pain in Chinatown. And today we're back in Los Angeles, albeit over 10 years later, to see if Guy Pearce & Co. can save the city's reputation after some grisly murders in 1997's L.A. Confidential.
The Night Owl Massacre. This is a heinous crime that requires swift resolution. Six victims. One of them, one of our own.
There's something wrong with the Night Owl. I just can't prove it.
We'll have a champion at the end of the show, but which film will it be? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken.
Hello, Clash Podders. Don't start trying to do the right thing, boy. You haven't had the practice. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Rollo Tomassi.
Rollo Tomassi. These were Chris's choices. So he gave Vicky Chinatown. We did that on Monday. That was great fun.
Thank you.
Enjoyed that. Which means you gave me LA Confidential. So today I will be your eyes and ears around the seedy underbelly of 1950s Los Angeles. After crime boss Mickey Cohen is locked up, a vacuum is created in the world of organized crime in 50s LA, and someone is trying to fill it. But who? After a series of multiple murders at the Night Owl Diner, a trio of cops, for varying reasons, make it their mission to find out. Guy Pearce's career-driven righteous crusader, Ed Exley, Russell Crowe's Punch First, Punch Again Later, Bud White, and celebrity cop Kevin Spacey's Jack Vincennes. What follows is a tour of the dark side of LA, with hookers cut to look like movie stars, entrapment rackets with Danny DeVito's sleazy tabloid hack Sid Hutchins, and a lot of bloody murder.
How's it gonna look in your report?
It'll look like justice. That's what the man got. Justice. You don't know the meaning of the word, you ignorant bastard.
Ladies and gentlemen, for your consideration, LA Confidential. Right.
Very good.
Yeah? Happy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
you nailed it.
You nailed it.
No, you nailed it.
Thanks very much. So, what are your previous experiences with LA Confidential, Chris?
Big fan. I watched this when it came out in 97 and I loved it. Bought it on video, watched it a few more times the next couple of years.
Oh, so this is a multiple watch for you?
Yeah, this is one of my favourite films of all time when it came out. I was excited. I was a big fan of disgraced actor Kevin Seedy, Spacey Seedy. I like the director. It was just, it won the Oscars, I think, by the time I saw it. Oh, no, it hadn't, because it came out before the Oscars in the UK. Mm. I was just a big fan of this one. I like the time period. I like the plot. I like that it got me into reading some James Ellroy. Yeah, super fan of this.
Victoria?
I also love this film. Mm. So I saw it and I loved it, but I didn't quite understand what had happened, so I haven't read the book. Then I read the script and I was obsessed with the script for years.
Yeah, you were saying this, I don't know if it was on the show, but when we were talking about this last week, you were saying that this script you learnt so much from.
Yeah, because it's very tight, but it's also very detailed. Beautifully detailed where it needs to be. But interestingly, for me, the character descriptions are really sparse. So when you think about how much life those actors bring to those parts, it's fascinating that that's not overwritten in the script. Mm. So Bud is just, I think he just says, oh, he's a tough guy, but he's earned it. That's it. And it's like, okay, cool. And Lynn is just a glamour girl who belongs in the movies. And that to me is amazing, because it gives the actors a lot of show, don't tell to do with the characters.
So what you're saying when you're talking about those descriptions is when you're reading the scripts, that is what it says next to their name as they're introduced in the screenplay.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
It's that. That's all it says. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? And when you think about the amount of detail that the writers have put in, so Brian Hagelland, and didn't Curtis Hanson have a pass, or did he co-write it? I can't remember.
They co-wrote it.
But you know you've got an expert guide showing you through that world, lobbing detail at you, and yet it still hangs together as a really well-told story, which is really, really accomplished.
I watched it. I was a teenager, I think, when I saw it. I don't exactly remember when, but the one standout thing for me that I took away from watching this movie was Russell Crowe.
Yes.
This is one of those films where I saw an actor for the first time. This is the first movie I'd seen Russell Crowe in, and I immediately went, well, there's a movie star. Mm. Done. There is a movie star, and what a calling card.
He was really heavily hyped in the run-up to this, because I remember when The Quick and the Dead came out, everyone was talking about this new Australian actor who's going to be the next big thing, and then that flopped. And then the next film he did was Virtuosity. Mm-hmm. This Australian actor who's going to be the next big thing, and he's terrible in it. I love the film, but he's terrible in it. It's a good, bad film. And so this was when he finally proved that Romper Stomper wasn't a fluke and that he could be the next big thing.
See, I'd only seen Romper Stomper, so he made sense to me in this one.
Sure, sure. But in the book, he's a giant, Bud White. And so Crowe thought he didn't have a chance of getting the role. Mm. And they weren't sure about casting him because the bloke is supposed to be a physical giant. Mm. And Russell Crowe isn't.
Yeah.
Acting.
Yeah. I mean,
it's called acting.
You would watch this and go, a terrifying giant of a man, just because of the way he plays the role. A little bit about how this came to be then. Warner Brothers bought the rights to James Ellroy's third book in his LA Quartet series just after it came out in 1990. Brian Helgeland heard that they had the rights and asked if he could adapt it into a screenplay because he was a huge Ellroy fan. Warner's basically said, no dice, Brian. No one's saying that they didn't like Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master, but that doesn't get you a James Ellroy adaptation. So Helgeland, using his own brand of detective work, finds out Curtis Hanson is directing, tracks him down on the movie, on the set of his film The River Wild. They get along like a house on fire. They both love James Ellroy, and they both agree on how to adapt this unfilmable book by reducing its 8, I believe, storylines into just 3. So you've read the book, Chris.
Yes.
Good?
Yeah, it's terrific. But yeah, as you say, they did jettison a lot of it. Elroy reckons they adapted only about 20% of his book.
Mm.
And they pretty much cut out any scene that didn't involve these three characters or didn't drive their stories forward. So, which you had to do. You know, there was no way of filming it. It would have been a TV series otherwise.
Mm. And by all accounts, James Ellroy is very happy with their adaptation.
Yeah, he loves it. He's in all the documentaries talking about it. He refers to the book. He says, "LA Confidential is a book for the whole family. If your family is the fucking Charles Manson family." he's such a frightening dude. But yeah, he believes that they preserved the basic integrity of the book and its main theme. And there's only one thing he's upset about, which I'll get to in my changes.
Okay.
I
think when he saw it for the first time, I think it was about 40 minutes in, he sort of declared it's a different piece of art to his book, but magnificent in its own right. Have you read it, Victoria?
No,
I haven't read it either. I did read a few bits and pieces around it for this, but we'll talk about them as we go on, because they sound like some major changes.
Major changes, yes.
Major changes.
Yeah, we'll talk about them.
We touched on the casting of this. Curtis Hanson had seen Crow in 1992's Romper Stomper, and his quote is, "He found him repulsive and scary, but captivating." And I couldn't find out whether Curtis Hanson had seen him in 1995's Virtuosity. Guy Pearce auditioned. He'd previously, I guess the biggest film he'd done at that point was Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. Curtis Hanson decided not to watch that, so it wouldn't influence his decision. I also couldn't find out if he'd seen any of the 496 episodes of Neighbours Guy Pearce was in.
It is funny. He said he cast him because he wanted someone that audiences wouldn't know. But if you're of a certain age in England, everyone knows who Guy Pearce is. Yeah. And so it just doesn't work for a particular demographic in a couple of countries.
Yeah. He was Mike Young in Neighbours, although I never watched Neighbours, so I wasn't aware of it. No.
Yeah, him and Plain Jane Superbrain. It was a love story for the ages.
That's right.
What are you talking about?
They were a hot couple.
They were.
She was geeky, but when she took off the glasses, guess what? She's pretty.
Yeah, when she put her hair down, she looked completely different.
Yeah. Plain Jane, super brave.
But like you say, both of them were pretty much unknown in Hollywood at this point. And Hanson cast them for this reason that we have talked about on this show before, which is that you don't know them as they arrive on screen. The audience has no preconceptions about the kind of characters they were going to be because they weren't film stars at that point, which I think is always exciting.
Yeah.
Always exciting when you're seeing someone for the first time. And it was certainly my experience of watching this. No idea what kind of characters Bud and Exley were going to be, especially with Exley at the start being quite dislikable.
Yes.
Hanson, his own words on this are, he wanted to replicate his experience of the book. You don't like any of these characters at first, but the deeper you get into their story, the more you begin to sympathise with them. I didn't want actors audiences knew and already liked. So those two roles were filled by Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe without too much pushback from the studio. Hanson now needed some actors to put in the foreground of the poster. So step forward Kim Basinger and Kevin Spacey, who despite having smaller roles, are literally five times the size of Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe on the poster.
Yeah, well, I guess Spacey is coming off the back of an Oscar win.
Mm.
So the studio said no to his casting. And then once he won the Oscar, they said yes to his casting. I guess you could say Kim Basinger's career was on the wane at that time.
Yep.
But she was, you know, a household name, a recognisable face. And the other one's Danny DeVito as well. You know, potentially probably the most famous person in this film.
Yeah.
I don't think
made the poster, though. All I remember, it was a really iconic poster. It was Kim Basinger really up front, then Kevin Spacey, then Guy Pearce, and then Squint, and there's Russell Crowe right in the back there. The only final thing I'd like to mention is the look of the film, because it's an incredible-looking film, and Curtis Hanson said he didn't want this to be an exercise in nostalgia, so he had his cinematographer, Dante Spinotti, who did the incredible cinematography on Last of the Mohicans, shoot it like a contemporary film. And that makes it accessible for me, who doesn't like old movies.
Well, it's very bright,
isn't it?
You associate film noir with darkness, and there's a lot of... I mean, there's brightness in Chinatown when you've got a lot of stuff to do with the water, but it's also pretty dark, whereas this film is not a dark film. Mm. But interestingly, of the casting, the other thing I would say is that although none of the actors look like their characters in the book, none of them do, Elroy says now that when he goes back to read those books... he sees these people and not who he wrote in the first place. So now, that's interesting.
That's interesting as just a reader of the book, like a member of the public who's picked up a book and then you start seeing the actors from a film when you're reading the book. But as the author of the book, you've clearly got an image of what they look like in your mind. And
especially when he wrote
them.
Four books in the series.
Yeah.
But now I guess when he does readings of them, he's seeing these guys.
So shall we go through this film?
Let's do it.
All right, so... we begin with some narration. Danny DeVito, setting up the situation as he writes an article for Hush Hush, the gossip and scandal magazine based on the real-life gossip and scandal magazine Confidential that was around in the 50s and redefined celebrity journalism. So I timed this narration, 2 minutes 30. Are you happy with that, Victoria, or do we have another layer cake on our hands?
No, it's a long one, but it's not 10 minutes, is it?
No.
So, and it is needed, I think, because of the amount of stuff it's got to get through. And it's very entertaining.
It's entertaining. Yeah, I don't know if it's all 100% relevant. It's just fun. It starts the film off on a very different note to where it proceeds to. But interestingly, this is the presentation. That voiceover is the presentation that Curtis Hanson gave to the studio to get the green light. He took and the cast, he took them to the Formosa, which is still there in Santa Monica. Some of the film is shot there, and he had photos and newspaper articles, and he would do this presentation, show the photos, show the articles for 10 minutes, and that would tell the story of LA Confidential in his words. And that's what got the film made. So I think it was very personal to him to get that into the opening scene.
I got a bit confused with all the different locations because I know some of them are still there. The Formosa is what doubles as the Night Owl in the movie?
No, the Formosa is where they make the mistake with Lana Turner and Tony Stampinato. Yeah, it's this very cool bar where you can sit down and have drinks at booths. And actually that presentation he has now done, it's on the DVD and it's on YouTube. I'll post it, but you can watch the presentation that he uses to get the film made, which is really cool.
It's a great scene setter for understanding the world of LA in this moment. And the big takeaway is that this crime boss, Mickey Cohen, has been jailed. And the big question mark over the film is, who is it trying to take his place?
So from the off, we're mixing fantasy and reality because Mickey Cohen was real. Johnny Stampinato was real. It's interesting, but the characters that we're following in the film are not real.
And those characters, our three main players, are introduced really quickly. Bud White is up first, Russell Crowe's character. He is stopping a guy who's beating his wife, from which we find out Bud White hates that.
And he hates it.
He hates it.
Sure, don't tell. So what's fantastic about the three characters of Jack Vincennes and Ed Exley and Bud White is you've got Jack on one side, who is possibly bad, but more lazy and vain, right? Then you've got Ed Exley, who is completely good, righteously good. But then in the middle is Bud, because Bud wants to be good, but Bud is bad because he does bad things. But he will go above and beyond to do the right thing by women. So when he you know, intervenes in that domestic and then gives her some money, he doesn't need to give her the money. That's a big character tell of, like, go and get yourself sorted kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a great intro where the husband comes out and goes, "Who the hell are you?" And he just goes, "The ghost of Christmas past." I'm like, that's a cool intro.
That's cool, yeah.
I'm already in love with your character.
Yeah.
Your violent character.
Yeah.
Next up, Jack Vincennes, Kevin Spacey's character, like you say, loves publicity, not above taking bribes to further his fame.
Arrested Bob Mitchum, they say, and famously Bob Mitchum did get arrested for smoking weed.
And was on the cover of Confidential magazine, the Hush Hush equivalent, And then we get Ed Exley, who is, like you say, he's very, very good. He's also quite dislikable with his good. He's one of those people that would just annoy you if you, like, they're so righteous and they're so, like, you know, when he doesn't take the $10 bribe from Kevin Spacey's character, he's like the white knight of the LAPD, believes in doing things honestly. And shortly after that, those are the three main guys.
He's also son of the legendary
Preston
Exley. Yeah. And I think that is super important. The more time I watch it, the more important that seems to become, especially if you're trying to fill in blanks around this version of the story as to actually what happened to Preston. which I'd like to talk about later. But yeah, so he is trying to live up to that. And that's, I think, part of the reason why he behaves in the way he does in terms of being as good as gold. Mm.
And then we get introduced to Kim Basinger's character, who enters the film, enters an off-licence, dressed as the Scottish Widows advert.
I've got Festive Grim Reaper. But that's not in the script. Excuse me. That's the interesting. In the script, she's got her hair in a handkerchief, so she's meant to look like she's getting ready for a party. So she's like, so she's not this... That's an early version of the script. It's like from 95. But the distance travel between I've just got my hair knotted up to Scottish Widows, Festive Grim Reaper is immense, obviously. Well,
why Russell Crowe doesn't go, I've already done the Ghost of Christmas Past joke, so that really should have been yours. Yeah. That should have been yours.
Yeah.
So then the plot sort of starts in motion with Bloody Christmas, which really shakes things up for all our main characters. After loads of cops, led by Bud White's partner, Dick Stensland, who, FYI, never as a man seemed like a corrupt cop more than him. He screams corruption. So they go and beat up some Mexican prisoners, and Guy Pearce decides, right, I'm going to testify against them.
But then this is what's interesting about this scene is there's a lot of talk in the film about when the sort of the heads of the police, like, we're doing this for the people of LA, we need to do these things, you know, we're representing the people. So there's a lot of talk of the people, right? But the people are absent from this film, because even the Mexican men that are in prison, what happens to them is unjust, but they have beaten up a cop. So they don't represent pure good people in that sense, like they've committed a crime. And then later on, the rape and kidnap victim, she isn't even as pure as good as you would kind of need. Like, she does lie. She lies for very understandable reasons, but she still lies. And then even later on, you've got the actor Matt, who is innocent in this, but when you first meet him, he's being busted for smoking weed, so even his innocence is marred somehow. So where are these people that everyone is doing all this stuff for?
All nowhere. Right, Ed Exley. Why?
I know, it
he
is
smoked
weird.
A bit of weed.
It is weird that they're like, oh, hopheads prowling the streets. It's just a bit of weed, but fine. And then Danny DeVito is quite obsessed with like the narc division. So when Kevin Spacey is on Vice, Danny DeVito's like, I don't give a shit about that. It's like, why do you not give a shit about that? Like, imagine all the fun stuff that he's going to see. Mm. But they're just really into drugs.
My favourite bit of that punch-up, though, is Jack Vincennes is not getting involved in the punch-up until someone gets a bit of blood on his shirt. and then he loses it. And it's that's such a great character moment, though, to sum up his vanity.
Yeah. It's a big no-no to testify against your fellow officers, but Guy Pearce, he's a white knight, and he goes, I'm going to do it, but I want a big promotion. So,
are you truly prepared to be despised in the department? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yes. He's so matter-of-fact about it.
Yeah, and like you say, Spacey loses his cushy job on the show and in the narcotics department, so he's not getting those tasty bribes.
He's told that Bud White will fuck him for the rest of his life over this. Again, he doesn't care. Great, yeah. It's just great. I love that hard-boiled dialogue, though.
Yeah.
Because it's quite extreme, but it's believable enough that it's so juicy and fun to hear. And it's obviously fun for these actors to deliver as well. They're all having a ball.
And at this point, I took a moment. I was like, I'm already really gripped by this film. Again, I've seen this before, and I'm loving this. And I think it's because the film walks a really fine line between, like, not being too convoluted for an audience to check out and go, oh, sorry, what's going on? And not laying everything out on a plate for you. Mm-hmm. It's like you feel clever watching this film and going, I am following this. So we get to the big turning point, which is the Night Owl Massacre, which is like something out of a fucking horror movie. It's really grim, the way he makes his way into that back bathroom following the trail of blood, and there's the pile of bodies there in the restroom. And we also, around this point, get the burgeoning of Bud and Lynn Bracken, Kim Basinger's character, their romance. And we learn a little bit about what she does and who she is. She explains to Bud that Pierce Patchett runs the Fleur-de-Lis, an escort agency that specialises in sex workers cut to look like famous movie stars. I find that expression quite difficult
to swallow. Yeah, it's nasty, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
It's the use of the word cut is unpleasant there. But it's not all bad because they, in her words, they still get to act a little, and he doesn't beat them or let them use narcotics.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of that's good.
Russell Crowe is superlative in this scene when he meets Lynn and she's explaining that she's meant to look like Veronica Lake. And he says, it's, cause it should be a really cheesy line, you look better than Veronica Lake. But the look on his face, he is surprised that he said it, and he's surprised that he's allowed to...
Well, yes, because he's just spent about 2 minutes basically calling her a whore and using that word.
Yeah.
And then the fact he doesn't tell her she looks like Veronica Lake, all's forgiven, and she's in love with her.
But not
she's
quite. In love with him. Yeah, but not quite. So if you watch this, like, watch the scene with, like, with this, and I went into it sort of cold and was so impressed again by Russell Crowe's face acting.
Mm.
Because he goes, you look better than Veronica Lake. And then she's a bit like, oh, okay, that's cool then. But he's surprised that he said it. And he's like, oh, shit. And he sort of wants to take it back because that's a vulnerability because he's like chatting her up, whatever. Then when they go to the door, he asks her out on a date. She reverts to type, which is what she's paid to do, which is to be a coy flirt. So he's like, we should go out. And she's like, well, I should know your name first. And then he's like, forget it. Just forget I ever said anything. Because he's been exposed. She's done what she's paid to do. He's seen that. I am not seeing the real you. I'm seeing the Veronica Lake impersonator. And I don't want that. But obviously he really does. And that scene is amazing.
It's a brilliant scene. Yeah. It's a brilliant scene.
The next scene, I think, is, if not as brilliant, more brilliant, which is when they finger three guys for the Night Owl murders. And we get this interrogation scene, which is magnificent. So they've got the three suspects in separate rooms, and Guy Pearce, with James Cromwell, go and watch him work. He's actually going to be really good at this. And he flicks the microphones on and off so they can each hear. But as this is progressing, you realise he's trying to ask them about the Night Owl murders, and it becomes apparent. We're drip-fed this idea that actually there's something else going on here. And these guys think they're being collared for a woman that they have trapped somewhere and had sex with and may still be trapped there and may be alive or dead. And the growing tension and the expression on Guy Pearce's face when he's like, no, actually, wait, what are you talking about? Because that's not what I'm talking about. What is this? And then Bud White, because he does not like violence against women.
Or chairs.
And he loves violence against chairs.
I can't believe he snaps a chair.
It's ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Because at this point, you're like, we get it.
Yeah.
You are not into that. And that is great. But then he's like, oh, yeah!
I think it's just...
It's a Hulk moment.
It's emphasising the Hulk thing. I was going to say. He is a blunt instrument.
Yes.
That they just have to point in the right direction. Like they learn to do with the Hulk in the Marvel films. But what's brilliant about that scene as well, and what does up the ante and the tension, is Dante Spinotti, who came up with the idea of showing everyone's reflection in the mirror, in the glass, so you can see the people watching it all unfold, which I think is Guy Pearce or Russell Crowe were talking about. I didn't really understand what he meant or how it was going to work. And then when you watch the film back, it's amazing because you can see all these different levels of everyone realising what's happening at different points. Mm. It's just brilliantly shot and so well crafted in terms of giving out the information.
It's wonderful until the very end where I feel it's kind of spoiled by slipping into cliche, because the bit where Bud White enters the room and drops all the bullets from the chamber of the gun, bar one, and then spins it and puts it in the guy's mouth. First of all, like him going, where's the girl? When you've got a barrel in someone's mouth, they're like, duh, 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 duh. It's like rule one of don't have the gun in their mouth when they're trying to, jokes have been done about that.
Write it out. Yeah. Pictionary.
So that doesn't work for me. And then I was trying to sort of think about this idea that he's got a bullet in the gun and he pulls the trigger twice. Are we to assume he knows what part of the chamber the bullet is actually in at that point? Or is he basically willing to kill this guy, which seems self-defeating in the sense that the guy will no longer be able to tell him where the girl is, and also he will go to jail because you can't shoot a suspect. So I'm a bit confused about that. Do you think he knows where the bullet is, or he's just lost his shit?
The fact they haven't shown you or established it, it's for you to decide. Mm. Alex, what do you think?
I think he dropped all the bullets out made it look like there was a bullet in the gun.
I think so too. Mm. Because I think a lot of this film is Bud and us realising that Bud isn't as stupid as he thinks he is.
Of course, that's what it's all about.
He thinks he's a dumb idiot and he isn't, and that's very clever.
To go back to that, the look on his face, again, face acting. When he's in the...
You just called it acting.
Or just acting. Yeah, face acting. His face does a lot of acting.
Is he not moving any other part of his body at that point? Is that why...
He's not speaking.
Right.
He's
his
still,
hands.
He's, no. It's in his face.
Right.
So when he's in the restaurant with James Cromwell and he's off, he's been suspended for his part in beating up the Mexican men. And James Cromwell says to him, I can get you back on the force. And his little face, because he is a little boy, really, still trapped on that radiator, horrendous story, whatever. And his face lights up and he says, like, working cases? I see, I can't do acting, but it's like that. Mm. And James Cromwell was like, don't be daft, beating the shit out of people. And he instantly reverts back to, oh, that's what everyone thinks of me. That's what I'm good at. And he's like, of course, sir, you know, I've no problem with that. Mm. But in that one moment, his face is like, I'm going to be a real detective. And it's heartbreaking.
It's great face acting.
It is.
It's great. If they ever bring back the Actors Studio, you need to host that and just talk to Sean Penn. Just be like, Sean, your face acting. Let's talk face acting.
You're second only to Russell Crowe.
And I, when you answer, don't speak.
You don't need to.
I actually understand your answer without words. That was incredible. Ladies and gentlemen, face actor,
you know,
Sean Penn.
That's just made me think of Johnny Depp said that he had lines fed to him on Pirates of the Caribbean 15 or whatever it was, not because he couldn't remember his lines, but because it allowed him to do better face acting. Which maybe that's where I've got
that's
it from.
Funny.
Yeah.
If only that was the biggest Johnny Depp story out there.
There's a lot I'm not saying.
But you mentioned the woman who is tied to the bed, who they rescue in the next scene, and she's called Inez. Mm. And actually in the book, the love triangle between Bud and Ed is with her,
right?
Not with Lynn Bracken. They switched it around. And so she did actually have a much more important role in the novel.
Oh, okay.
And it just completely got cut out. So she's just the victim in this film.
Guy Pearce has his Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer moment where he kills the suspects and all the other cops love him. Like he becomes Shotgun Ed.
Yeah, but that's the scene, isn't it, where he puts the shotgun in the lift.
Yeah,
is it that scene?
It is that scene. So my issue with this, which is very nitpicky, is that's meant to be the moment where he's like, I've become the thing I said I wouldn't become, right? Because yes. I've shot a suspect in order to stop a lawyer from asking tricky questions.
But we also, he shoved his gun in a lift and he can't see who he's shooting and there could be someone else in that lift.
And maybe we're meant to think he shot him in the back, which is what James Cromwell says to him earlier, but then maybe not because of the payoff with James Cromwell at the end. But I didn't see it as a moralistic slide as much as the writers wanted me to see it, because it's just the city doing to him exactly what James Cromwell said would happen. When he sticks the gun in the lift, he isn't doing it for his own gain at that point. He's doing it because he really believes that that man is the criminal that he's after. Do you know what I mean? He's not doing it to cover his tracks. He's not doing it for publicity. He's doing it because he thinks in the moment he's done the wrong thing for the right reasons, which is what James Cromwell said he would have to do. So later on, when he's sort of saying to Russell Crowe, I can't remember the scene, but the Rollo Tomassi scene, to Kevin Spacey, where he's like, I've become something, you know, that I'm not happy with. I don't really see that. And I don't think that scene does that for me.
Okay, well, we'll discuss that more right after this break.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is just around the corner, and it's time to pamper the special moms in your life. And what better way than with Osea's limited edition skincare sets featuring clean, vegan, cruelty-free products that are safe for your skin and the planet. Osea is a women-founded, women-led brand that's been making seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. This Mother's Day, Osea has two limited edition sets, perfect for gifting or keeping for yourself. Their Golden Glow body set includes three clinically proven bestsellers for silky, smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set has everything she needs to achieve spa-level results at home. They're so beautiful, you can skip the wrapping. For a limited time, you can save up to $48 on Osea sets, plus get free shipping. That's Mother's Day made easy. Pamper the moms in your life and get 10% off your first order site-wide with code MOM at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code MOM.
Cool, yeah, I sort of see what you mean. Yeah, because it's only much later on that he has that moment of the revelation where he's like, I think I might have killed the wrong guys.
Yes.
At that point in time,
he thinks they did it.
Yes. Yeah. While all this is going on, Bud and Lynn's relationship is escalating and they sleep together in a really sweet way. Now, I might have misread this, but it appears to me she sort of takes him from the staging area.
Yeah, to her bedroom.
Of her place to her private bedroom.
Yes.
Where she would not sleep with a client normally.
Yeah.
Because we learn that she's actually a really quite wholesome person, and we learn that through embroidery.
We do, because she doesn't get to say it. So.
Because embroidery, wholesome.
Yes, equals wholesome.
She just wants to open up a dress shop.
She
and
does.
That's it. So this is she won an Oscar for this, didn't she? Not for this scene, but for her.
She did.
And she is amazing. But yeah. It's the classic scene, again, like with Chinatown. They sleep together, tell me about yourself. And Russell Crowe tells the most horrific story that you've ever heard in your life, which is his dad killed his mum and he had to watch and he was chained to a radiator and he was there for 3 days.
That's right, yeah. She was dead. His dad, this is word for word, he goes, he beat her to death with a tire iron. I was chained to the radiator next to my dead mother for 3 days. Now, it's important character building stuff for Bud White, for Russell Crowe's character. Is it post-coital pillow talk? Is that the right moment? After you've just made love, do you go, I've got a story for you.
I've got a story for you.
She's dead. She's 3 days next to my dead
mother. Do you know what happens
mother.
To a body over
do you
three
days? Do you want to go again? Are you back in the mood?
When he said he's not that smart, this suggests that he really isn't. Doesn't it?
Yeah. He meant to say it, just leaning in for a second kiss. 3 days. Get up!
A tire iron.
Oh, dear. On a more serious note, he gets to tell his story, but she doesn't get to tell hers. And her character, you don't know anything about her apart from she wants to open a dress shop, but you don't know why she's there.
She's there to give the male characters an emotional journey to go on.
Okay.
And nothing else.
Well, I guess that's fine.
I think she's getting quite well paid. And also, she didn't have to get cut to play this part. They make a point of saying that she only dyed her hair blonde. She's a brunette, really. So she does just look like Veronica Lake.
Yeah.
But I imagine she's making money in Los Angeles.
Yeah, because she's going to buy a dress shop.
Yeah.
But what brought her there? You know, it's about the city of broken dreams and all the rest of it.
But earlier on when she says, we still get to act a bit.
Yeah.
The implication is surely she came to act and then that didn't work out. So now she's a sex worker and she still gets to act.
What
a little
I mean
bit.
Is there's time in that scene for a bit of parody. He tells the worst story you've ever heard in your life. And she's then supposed to go, well, guess what happened to me? Rather than go, oh,
it
look
was
at my pillow.
Four, it was 4 days for me.
It was four. Yeah, I did four, actually, which is...
And the radiator was on and it was very hot. Very hot.
Oh, dear.
So let's move away from radiator sex. Kevin Spacey and Danny DeVito are busy setting up the actor from The Mentalist. I really wish I'd written down his name.
Simon
that
Baker.
That was really bugging me.
Simon Baker.
Of course.
Yeah. Simon Baker, yeah, they're setting him up.
I thought no one had ever watched The Mentalist. Am I seeing people who watch The Mentalist?
I saw a lot of the posters.
I thought it's just one of those shows that exists but no one actually watches, apart from maybe my mum.
I think I saw a trailer on Channel 5. They've already screwed him over once, ruined his career, and now they're telling him that he has to go and have sex with the DA. And this is it for Kevin Spacey, for Jack Vincennes. He's had a change of heart. And he's become something he can no longer deal with. Another bit of a cliche, he realises this by looking at himself in the mirror questioning what he's
become.
Who am I?
He looks at himself in the mirror quite a lot in the film, though. It's not just a one-off there. It's something that he... I think it's a character trait as well. Mm. But I agree with what you say. It's quite cringeworthy watching... disgraced actor Kevin Spacey in this role, I think, in terms of he's playing a character who's presenting a public face that's very different to his private face. And we're getting to look behind that mask. You know, he says to someone, this can be our little secret. Mm-hmm. It's very creepy. And I think it ties in with actually two or three of his most famous roles where he did tend to play these very manipulative, unpleasant characters below the surface. And if you've ever met Kevin Spacey, you know, he was playing himself. It's grim.
Yeah.
He was my favourite actor at this period. My favourite actor. And I go up until the point I interviewed him, and then all that changed when I met him. But he's so good in this role. But you look back now and you see he was playing himself, essentially, I think. Very charismatic, but a broken, nasty piece of work under the surface.
I've never interviewed him. But you remember...
probably won't now. That's not coming up anytime soon.
I don't think you should. If he asks, say no.
The first time I saw this, though, I remember being quite impressed with his charisma in the role because he's on paper, Jack Vincennes is a thoroughly unlikable character who's screwing over this kid who has no qualms about screwing over other people's. But it is Spacey's charm, as I said when I first watched this, that makes you go, he's sympathetic. Like, you do sort of, well, if not sympathetic, you quite like him.
He is. Yes. He is. No, he is, because when they ask him why he's doing the job and he says, I can't remember, and the look in his eyes, it's haunting. Like, he's very good at that. The regret and the pain. And the charisma, as you say, like, they told him, Curtis Hanson told him, this guy's Dean Martin. And he captures that. He captures that cool as well. Yeah. He really does, that swagger.
Yeah, this is a point in the film where all our main trio are realising things. So Spacey's realising that he doesn't like who he's become. Bud realises he is smart enough to try and find the real Night Owl killers. And the lion realises he's got courage and it's just like the
That's good. I like that.
Exley has to accept he's not infallible and might be wrong and justice hasn't been done and the real killers of the Night Owl are still out there. At which point, a movie that has already been fantastic to this point just goes up a gear as we enter this final act. It's incredible. Moment after moment. We start with a little bit of levity, which is beautiful and just relaxes you before the horrors to come. But that Lana Turner scene is just great.
Yeah, it's amazing that it is funny because we don't know who she is, obviously, because it's not Lana Turner.
Yeah.
So it could fall flat because we'd be like, oh, God, well, how are we supposed to fucking know? But it doesn't.
It doesn't.
And she's with the gangster, Johnny Stompanato, who Lana Turner was married to in real life. Do you know that story?
No.
Yeah, she was married to this gangster and he was abusive towards her.
Right.
And her 13-year-old daughter murdered him.
No, I didn't know that.
She didn't get done for it. It was justified manslaughter.
Wow.
So it was huge. It was as big a scandal as you could get in Hollywood. And
it's interesting because Johnny Stompanato is in the script that I read. He's in it a lot more. Because he's not really in this. Mm. He's got that big scene and the Lana Turner scene, but he's in it right from the start.
Well, I was going to wait for my changes, but yeah, that scene, that moment, which is, you know, a very funny moment, but also it's a good moment because they get out to the car outside and Ed Exley starts laughing and you just see a different side to him. You're like, oh, it humanises him.
Yeah.
And the fact that Bud starts to like... Ed around this time. Well, a bit later in the film.
Yeah.
Sorry, a bit later in the film.
He starts to hate
him a bit. All right, we'll come to that. But Elroy hates that scene because Lana Turner and Johnny Stompanato didn't get together until 4 years later.
Okay.
In real life. And so he's still pissed off about that because people think that he wrote that and he didn't.
Well, to go on to why Bud White hates Ed Exley, it's because Ed Exley and Lynn have sex while Danny DeVito photographs them. And you're like, uh-oh, Bud White is going to get you.
I'm not sure how much I buy that sex scene between the two of them. I'm not sure Guy Pearce... He's giving a strange performance. He's kind of snorting through his nose while he's talking to her. And it's like, is that what you do when you get turned on?
No, because he's trying to be a tough guy because he thinks that's the way to do it because he knows that she likes Bud.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know. Right. I can't decide still after having seen it and read it. Is the whole thing a massive setup? So she was never into Bud. She's been told to sleep with him and told to like make him... think that she really likes him, so show him your embroidery, which is not a euphemism.
No, that is what Kim Basinger calls it.
Sorry, that's just my sort of, that's hilarious. Anyway, so it's none of it is real. So in order to have leverage over him so that you can set him off like a dog, like you need to at any point in time, because he's now got this Achilles heel, which is his affection for her. Or is it real? And then the way Guy Pearce talks to her is the way that he thinks Bud is, which is like to be a big tough guy, to insult her, to do it, you know, to intimidate her and not force her, but it's not great. But then she has this shield of, and that's what winds him up, is like what we believe is her real affection for Russell Crowe, because he cannot get through to her in the way that he's trying to, and it doesn't work. Mm. So it makes him angry. But then she has to do this thing for her boss anyway.
I know. I think it's that her affection for Bud is real.
Yeah.
And then James Cromwell's character finds out about this relationship
and then uses it
okay. To set Bud off onto Guy Pearce.
Okay.
I have to believe that because I think otherwise...
It's very cynical.
Yeah, and it changes her character
but she
completely.
But she has a moment in the police station later where whoever is apologising to her for what... Because Russell Crowe then hits her. And isn't it Guy Pearce that says he hates what he's become or he hates what he did?
Yeah.
She says, oh, I know how he feels. Mm. So what is she talking about there? Is she talking about sleeping with Guy Pearce?
Yes.
Or is she talking about the whole thing?
Oh, I think it's just about sleeping with Guy Pearce. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what I think anyway. That's what I think. Then we get the biggest shock of the whole movie. Had you read the book before you saw this? Did you?
No.
Okay. So at this point, had either of you gone, I think James Cromwell is the bad guy? Or when Jack Vincent...
No, because he's kindly.
Yeah.
I mean, he's scary, but he's usually a kindly, right? Avuncular man.
And one of the reasons they cast him is because of Babe.
Yes.
They said that we really feel like audiences are going to come in with such goodwill towards this man that it will really help us in the film. And no, I didn't spot it coming, even though, and that's the brilliance of the script, you know, you watch it a second time, he is telling you from the beginning who he is. He's very clear about it. He's got this homespun Irish, you know, friendliness and calling people boyo and stuff. But actually, if you're listening to what he's saying, this is a mean, nasty piece of work, and he's hiding in plain sight, but it's brilliantly hidden.
Yeah, it turns out that he is the one who is filling the vacuum created by Mickey Cohen's death and the death of Jack Vincennes. What a moment. I remember the first time I saw it. It knocked me sideways. Mm. It's fantastic. And, you know, it comes at a point where Jack Vincennes is finally trying to do the right thing as well. So you've warmed to him even more. And then just out of nowhere, dead. And if that wasn't enough, you then get that little kicker at the end where he says Rollo Tomassi and smiles. Mm. Now,
and then you watch the art that you watch him die. So how did he act that? It looks like the
face
life
acting.
Is disappearing.
It's face acting.
it's
literally face
acting. It is face acting.
And actually how he did it, because the camera stays on him even after James Cromwell moves away.
Yeah.
He got one of the ADs to draw a circle on the wall behind where Cromwell was standing, because he said, I just couldn't not look at him as he moved away, and so I would just stare at that, and that's why you've got this moment where his eyes kind of focus out, I guess.
Now, does he say Rollo Tomassi there because he is like, you are Rollo Tomassi? I've had the explanation from Guy Pearce of who this fictional character, Rollo Tomassi, is the guy who always gets away with it. And, oh my God, you've just killed me. And you're that guy. Or does he say it in the knowledge that James Cromwell may repeat it to Guy Pearce in the future, yeah, and thus give himself away as the bad guy?
I think it's either both, or if you can't have both, it's definitely the latter, because right, he's becoming good. So in his final breath, he does one last good thing, which is leave these breadcrumbs.
Mm. Yeah, it's a clue. I think 100% it's a clue from beyond the grave.
It works, because that moment where he does sidle up to Guy Pearce and go, oh, so just looking for this, just an associate of Jack Vincennes. Does the name Rollo Tomassi mean anything to you?
His reaction is incredible.
It's really good. It's a really good face acting.
It's brilliant face acting. Everyone's such a good face actor.
It's his best face acting in this movie.
Yeah,
he acts the shit out of his face in that scene.
He really does. It's a little bit sloppy police work, because it seems that James Cromwell's not done like a basic check, and then someone would say this person doesn't exist.
No internet.
He's just gone straight to...
He could Google Rollo Tomassi. He would have found out it's an indie band.
Oh, it's not, is it?
Yeah, an indie band that named themselves Rollo Tomassi after this film came out.
Oh, man.
But after the film.
That's still
Guy,
bad.
Guy Pearce isn't a huge fan of what? Van called Rollo Tomassi. Here, I've got an idea for the name.
That's interesting, though. Rollo Tomassi is an invention for this film. It's not in the book.
That's true.
They made up the plot point,
really?
They made
okay.
up the name. So that's complete invention, which is maybe the best plot point in the film.
Yeah.
Certainly the most satisfying as a viewer. And it's new. Curtis Hanson, yep, and Hengeland.
Yep. James Elroy didn't mention that, though. More about the Lana Turner scene. 4 years difference. But this is fine.
Around this time as well, we see Danny DeVito getting beaten up and killed. Mm. And I think that's interesting as well. We're, you know, talking about Cromwell and coming with, you know, goodwill towards an actor. It's so painful to watch Danny DeVito get beaten.
Yeah,
up.
It is.
And yet he is an evil bastard in this film. But because it's DeVito, I can't bear
it. He's not evil. He's just grubby.
He's destroying people's lives and driving them to suicide.
Yeah.
He's
terrible.
Yeah, he's a terrible man.
He has no... whereas Jack Vincennes, like, you know, regrets it and goes, I'm going to stop doing this by looking in a mirror. Danny DeVito, whether he has a mirror or not, we're not aware, but he does not look in a mirror and go, what have you become? And then Russell Crowe in one of the connections, I believe, that was made on Monday's show, there's some hitting of a woman. Now, he turns up at her house and he knows that she slept with Guy Pearce, and he hits her twice, really fucking hard. It's nasty. I'm a bit confused by this, because, like, his one thing is that he doesn't like men who beat up women. That's his big thing. And yet he does it to her. Now, are we meant to take from that that, like, he loves her so much that he's lost control in that scene?
No, that's not what it is. He was raised like that. That's what he saw every day of his life until his dad killed his mum. Mm. So when he's angry, he's reverting to what he thinks is the way to act in that situation. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what he saw. So when he loses control, but not because he loves her so much. He loses control because his power has been taken away from him. It's not about love. Mm. It's got nothing to do with love. Mm. It's got everything to do with power. Mm. So the whole film is like, you know, he kind of respects her job. He doesn't give her a hard time about what her job is. Mm. He understands what her job is. But then when it finally comes to it, he doesn't respect her job at all. She was paid to do her job. She didn't do it because she really wanted to, or she's not even showing off and saying, I had a fucking brilliant time, actually. She's like, I was paid to do this thing. So I was doing my job, like I've always been doing my job, the whole time we've been together. But because he doesn't like Guy Pearce, he's lost the power in that moment, and so he reverts back to type.
I'd understand that if he hadn't spent the whole film rallying against people who do just that. It's like, can you really have it both ways, where he's learnt... Like, what his lesson from watching what his dad did to his mum was to not do that and to ensure that no other man did that. But he's also reverting back to that and doing it himself.
But not from a place of love, from a place of anger, from a place of loss of control, from a place of having to share this woman with someone he doesn't want to share her with in his mind. Not because I love you so much. That doesn't make any sense. I love you so much, I'm going to hit you. That doesn't make any sense.
No, I guess I guess what I mean by that is, like, the vulnerability that comes with loving someone so much and having them wrong you.
Yes, but lots of people deal with that in different ways.
Oh, I know.
Yeah,
but
he doesn't, because his dad didn't, and that sort of thing. Like, I don't think, you know, he's learned from his dad, and we don't know anything about that relationship, but we assume it was continuously abusive. It wasn't a one-off incident where he just out of nowhere killed her with a tire iron. Mm. So it's a pattern of control and all the rest of it. And he's tried his whole life not to be that person. Now, there may be his idea of loving their son, which he's never been in this position before.
That's
it's never
what I mean. But that's
yeah,
what that's, I mean.
I think Alex is right. I think you're both saying the same thing pretty much.
Yeah,
but I think I'm agreeing with you that he's been pushed over the edge by this. He spent his whole life trying not to be that person.
Yeah, but he is that person.
And this has driven him there, yeah.
It would be better if he didn't hit her.
Yes.
It would be better if he went to do it, because that's who he is.
Yeah, and punched the wall or something.
Yeah. Just,
but then that's my point. That brings me back to why I don't quite get why that happens. I mean, I get why it happens, but I just mean, I think it's
disappointing.
Yeah,
I agree.
I think you're right. I think just punching the wall next to her, and you get the idea of, like, but for him to still have retained that his main quality,
his thing,
throughout the film, he manages to maintain it even when faced with that.
You can still show him having lost it, because he could go to do it and she could look like she knows he's going to do it, and that's enough. That is more than enough to show that moment has happened.
Because then the guilt would be there. And,
yeah,
and
of course.
It would,
he doesn't need to do it.
Great.
And she brushes it off really easily as well, like... He says sorry, and she goes, okay. And,
ow.
Yeah, fine.
Right then. After that, things start coming together. We start to see Ed and Bud working together after another fight in an office.
Yeah, it's interesting. You realise that they're actually, they're sort of half a good cop, each of them. And then when they're together, they'll make one good cop. Mm. And it's interesting, Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe added this stuff in where... as they're investigating together, as the climax approaches, one throws the other the keys, one throws the other the shotgun. And so they're almost working in unison. They're like a left and right hand working together.
The keys bit is really awesome. I think it's when they're in
Pierce Patchett's
house, and he chucks them a long way. Mm. And obviously... it works in a movie because Guy Pearce knows they're coming. I can't remember which way around they're thrown, but he does do it in this fluid motion where he's not even looking. He turns and just catches them. It's very, very cool.
And that was them. That was them coming up with that.
They throw the DA out of a window for a bit, or rather they throw his... Get a better stunt double. he's twice the size. And you can also... Did you see the rope attached to him in that scene?
No.
It's a bit sloppy. There's a bit where he's like hanging out the window and you can see the rope holding him in place. But, you know, I'm being petty. It's still a great scene. He fesses up about the whole thing. James Cromwell's the big bad. And then we get the shootout at the motel, the Viceroy Motel, I think it's called, which is a very cool shootout. Mm. I kind of wish we knew some of the people out. We've seen them in passing, but
who are the people outside? Are they cops?
Like
are they
officers?
Cops or are they hired? His hired gun.
That's a good point. I don't suppose
Dudley's
we know.
Hired guns. I wasn't sure.
Because then you do hear the police come in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
But those are the genuine police coming. I'm sure I recognise one of them from the police station earlier. But it's just a bit like we need bodies here. We need people to die, but we haven't introduced them at this point.
Yeah.
So they
we need an action oriented climax as well.
Yeah.
Which these stories don't traditionally have a film noir, but because I think the era we're in, there's an expectation that you've got to have the big. Exciting shootout.
A shootout in which, for all intents and purposes, we think Bud might be killed.
When he gets shot in the face, Alex. He gets shot in the face.
Yep.
Which I've got a bit of a problem with.
Yeah.
He's shot. He's sort of Swiss cheesed in his body, and then face shot is the one I'm thinking, that's probably got you.
It's the Jaws 4 scenario where Mario Van Peebles gets eaten by a shark, and yet they decided they wanted a happy ending where he wheels up to the plane in the final scene in his wheelchair, and it's like, Jake's alive!
I completely forgot, which is really shameful of me. But even in the end, doesn't he just got his arm in a sling?
Yep.
And they're like, oh, buddy, I hope you're all right. Yep. Yeah, I'm basically fine.
Yeah. In fact, there were two endings there to Jaws the Revenge, one with Mario Van Peebles and one without. I'll get back to this.
Yes.
I'll get back to this. Yeah, you're right. You're right. We're nearly hitting an hour. Okay, so, Ever the Politician, Exley gets another medal.
Well, just back a step. We didn't say he kills Dudley by shooting him in the back.
Yeah.
Which is such a lovely payoff, because the first thing Dudley says to him is, would you be willing to shoot a hardened criminal in the back? And Ed Exley says no. and he kills him in the back.
And yeah, this good.
Brilliant. It's brilliant,
that's
isn't
really
it?
This is obviously, are you going to bring up, he doesn't die in the book, Dudley Smith. And I find this puzzling. And again, without having read these books, I'm ill-equipped to have this conversation, but it's me. So in the books, he survives through this book and even into the end of the next book, White Jazz, the final book. Yeah. His character of Dudley Smith ends up in a retirement home, which seems strange, like, and lacks payback.
Yeah, but that's the world of James Ellroy. Like, right. A lot of the time, criminals don't pay. And the difference in the novel LA Confidential is that, because this is a series of books, the reader is, it's already been established in the previous book that Dudley Smith is a villain, is the bad guy. And so there's no twist, there's no surprise. He's just a bad guy in this story. So again, it's very different with his storyline, but, you know, much more satisfying.
Oh, yeah.
As an audience member in this film, but I think if you read the books, you know, that's the world that he's capturing.
It's great where he says, hold your badge up so they know you're a police officer. Yeah. He's like, that's what tips him over the edge. He's like, you fucking dick. And then, yes, so Exley gets himself another medal because you need two heroes. You can't just have dead Dudley Smith as a hero. You're going to want two heroes. So he gets a second medal Dudley gets to keep his reputation and isn't revealed as the big bad. But in better news, Bud is alive!
Bud is alive. Bud is alive.
So Ed Exley gets to be King Cop of, like, LA, and Bud goes to Arizona to make dresses and embroid.
when he gets to check out embroidery.
When Ed leads in the car, I think Bud should say to him, it's Chinatown, Ed.
That's pretty much all I've got. Anything else?
I've got a couple of bits. So yo. On the Blu-ray of this release, they've got the whole TV pilot that they made in 2000, which I watched.
Oh, the Kiefer Sutherland one.
Kiefer Sutherland is Jack Vincennes. Okay. He's the lead character. A couple of actors I do not recognise as the other two. Melissa George is Lynn.
Oh, I love her.
Eric Roberts is Pierce Patchett. And I think, although she's not listed in the credits, I think Mena Suvari is Marilyn Monroe and she plays a role in this. But it's very bad. It's very bad. It's Kiefer Sutherland's playing Jack Vincennes, very Jack Bauer. It's quite a different performance.
That's what I heard. I heard it's just kind of a grizzled, regular cop show.
It felt like that.
And there was the sequel. Are you going to mention the fact that there was a sequel planned in which Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe were going to return and it was going to be set in the 70s in... the late Chadwick Boseman was going.
I just read that today. I'm super surprised. I hadn't heard the Chadwick Boseman story. I had, because for years they've talked about doing a sequel, and I would have liked to have seen a sequel.
Yeah.
For me, though, that should have stopped when the moment, sadly, Curtis Hanson died about 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And I think it is a Hanson Helgeland thing. I think once he was gone, as the writer and the director, I felt like that was it for that project.
I think it was Brian Helgeland on 42 was when he first spoke to Chadwick Boseman about it. It's what it said, but like you say, it just came out in the press literally this month.
Yeah.
Right then, the bits.
Yeah, should we do the bits?
All right, let's do the bits. Okay, best scene, Christopher.
It's got to be the Rollo Tomasi Cromwell moment. I remember being in the cinema and gasping. But there's little bits in it that I like. Like, as he gets shot, Kevin Spacey's trying to get a bit of coffee off his finger that's spilt onto his finger, which is why you're not expecting it. It's such a simple thing, but you don't expect someone to get shot when there's a bit of coffee dribbling on the finger that they're trying to get off. that line, have you a valediction, boyo? It's just a perfect line, seeing the light goes out in his eyes. It's just, I love it.
Yeah. Agreed. That's mine as well, Victoria.
Really?
Yeah.
This scene I've picked, I can't believe we didn't talk about it more, but it's good because then I can talk about it now. When Russell Crowe goes to see Ed to kick the living shit out of him because he finds out about him being with Lynn, and he is beating the shit out of him, and Ed actually manages to squeeze out a little bit of the plot that they're involved in, and then you see the acting, Russell Crowe, the light goes on and he wants to kill this person, but he also wants to be smart and he wants to do the right thing and he wants to be good. So he throws a chair out of the window instead. And in that moment, he's just like, fuck's sake, like, I do want to kill you, but I will be smart, but I still have all this energy and all this anger and I need to do something with it. So I'm going to throw a chair through a window.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
No, I agree.
Although it is our second Russell Crowe destroying a chair moment.
That's
in
true.
It's our third.
Is it?
Yeah, he breaks two chairs and throws one out the window. It's some of the best chair acting I've ever seen.
Agreed.
What? 100%. There's face acting, yeah, there's chair acting. All right.
Agreed.
MVW, Victoria.
Russell Crowe, because of the
chair acting and the face acting.
The three moments. When he's trying not to be the person that beats the shit out of people, that's when he's just unbelievably good. So when he asks Lynn out and immediately regrets it, the chair through the window, when he thinks he's going to be a real detective, it's weird. He is a bad person in the way that he comports himself, the things that he does to possibly innocent people. Or there's a very like grey area. But... And this is pre him telling you the story about the radiator, which is horrible. To me, he seems like a little boy and that you want to look after him and you want him to be good and you're really, really rooting for him to do the right thing. Mm. And he seems like a sweetheart. Like he just does. But yet you don't see him do anything that isn't nasty and violent and horrible. But you would feel really safe with him. It's such a strange mix. Mm. Like he's done such an amazing job with that character.
Christopher.
I've written down some weird stuff here.
Okay.
Australia. Well done, Australia. They gave us the two lead actors and the mentalist in this film. So I'm kind of coupling that with casting director Marley Finn. She is the one that found Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe, got them in front of Curtis Hanson. So she launched multiple careers. For better or worse, I think obviously Russell Crowe's career has been very different to Guy Pearce's. I think he fulfilled his potential much better. But I'm going to go with Guy Pearce's teeth.
Right.
So the audition tape for this movie, the audition that Guy Pearce did is on the Blu-ray. Mm. And he's got very crooked teeth. And Curtis Hanson said to him, we want you to play Ed Exley, but you've got to get your teeth filed down. Oof. You've got to get your teeth sorted because Ed Exley needs to be perfect. He needs to have a perfect smile. He needs to have perfect teeth. And Guy Pearce did not like the sound of having his teeth filed down. He said, that sounds too painful. I'm not doing it. I don't fancy that. So he got caps. Guy Pearce has had caps ever since then. He has beautiful teeth. And having watched that documentary just before I watched it this week, I couldn't stop looking at his teeth. They're beautiful, except they're slightly too big for his mouth. And he said he did find it hard to do the accent with new teeth in this film. He had to do extra hard accent acting.
So wait, are they not... Is that not the same thing? But because a lot, a cap's different to veneers. Because in America, a lot of people have their original teeth filed down and then they have veneers put over the top. So I'd imagine that if he was going to have caps put on, he would have actually had them filed down as well. That's why so many Americans have great teeth, because they just file down your original teeth.
My front teeth are caps.
Oh, they really?
I'm not my teeth out of my 18th birthday.
Oh, yeah. I remember you telling us that, yeah.
Me and Guy have a lot in common.
Just because I know you want to be sure. Russell Crowe's from New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But he's lived all his life in Australia.
Right. Yeah.
Apologies. That is a mistake.
Okay, my MVW is New Zealander Russell Crowe.
I believe they're called Kiwis.
For all the reasons that we've discussed, you mentioned Victoria. He is absolutely incredible. Whatever happened to him as an actor between 1995's Virtuosity and this, it was a good thing. Something good happened between those two movies. And finally, what would you change? Victoria.
So... two things. When Lynn is at the end and she's reconciled with Bud, she should have let her hair go back to brunette, because that would have been a cute touch. Mm. But then a second bigger thing. So when Ed Exley and Bud White go to the DA's office to tell him that they know everything, they know about Dudley, Guy Pearce sets Bud on the DA, right? And that annoyed me because I want it to be more Bud's story than it is Ed's, and it kind of is Ed's story by the end, I think. Mm. So I don't think it should have just been a straight reverse where it's like, okay, all of a sudden Ed Exley is the muscle and Bud White is the brains, but something smarter in that moment that pays respect to the fact that Bud White has tried to go on this journey, not just, he's like, right, okay, get him, basically. And he does, and it works. But, or, you know, just something, you could even have something funny there in that moment where he's like, get him, and he says no, and he does it a different way or whatever, but not just throughout this whole film, I have watched this man struggle to be better than he is. And when it comes to it, the man that you've bonded with, against all odds, uses you like the weapon that you are. And that's not good enough for me. And that's it.
All right. Chris?
I found this was a bit of a journey. So for Chinatown, I didn't really have much to say apart from, you know, truncating certain scenes that we talked about. But nothing really specific. And I've always thought LA Confidential is a perfect movie in my head. Mm. I'm not going to have any changes for that. But actually, I've got a list. I was surprised myself. I'm not happy with James Cromwell's accent. Don't shoot Bud in the face, then have him live. Shoot him everywhere else, but not in the frigging face.
Shoot him through the cheek. I think you're allowed that. Go on.
That happy ending with them driving off into the sunset with the line, some men get the world, others get ex-hookers and a trip to Arizona. I feel it's weirdly out of place, that kind of happy ending. I know there's, you know, making Dudley the hero is dark of the story, but it just feels tacked on. It doesn't feel honest to me. But my actual change is I would have given Kim Basinger a lot more to do. I know she won the Oscar for the film, but her character only seems to be there to listen to the stories the men tell her and to serve their motivations. And so, you know, it's what you said, that I really felt that moment when they were in bed together. And I'd written that down, but you said it all, like she should have stories of her own to tell. I think it would have made it a richer film for that. So
mine is a very small thing, but it's the bit where the girl we see with the black eyes in the car that Russell Crowe approaches at the very start, and then later on she's dead. She's died in the night time, and we see her in the morgue, and Russell Crowe...
Susan Lefferts, I think.
Yes. And Russell Crowe sees her, and as the audience, you see him acknowledge who she is, and I certainly recognised her from the start. Yeah. And I really, really didn't feel that in a film that never uses any other stylistic tics or anything else, having the split screen of her moment earlier,
oh yeah,
talking to him from the back of the car going, hey, what are you worried about, mister? I'm fine. I'm like, I didn't need that.
Yeah. They do it again later, though.
Do they?
Yeah, with Stensland or
no,
with,
Meeks,
with Meeks. Yeah. With Bud Meeks, you get the flashback. And it's weird. It's a very weird stylistic choice, though.
Yeah, I didn't notice the other one, actually. I just thought in that moment, because it's split screen as well, so you're seeing... like it's
100% that came out of audience testing. 100% that the audience did not know what was happening, and they were like, we've got to do something.
I think, you know, it lowers the film in that moment, because a film that sort of is always, like I said earlier, it just walks that line perfectly between challenging you but not being confusing, in that moment it lowers itself to the stupidest person in the room. So I didn't like that.
I'd just like to do a shout as well. I forgot to say this earlier. Mrs. Lafferts, who plays her mother,
she's so good in
that film. It's really disturbing who this woman is.
Although I thought she'd done something bad. There is a bit where she's like, don't go in there. Don't go in there. I was like, she's killed someone.
That's what it's supposed to be. Gwenda Deacon. I wanted to give her, because I'm sure no one ever mentions her when they talk about this film, but I think she's really good in her two little scenes.
Right, that is LA Confidential. Yeah. Done. We end with Gwenda. Thank you. let's do
the verdict, shall we? Who wants to go first?
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth.
Vicky.
Oh no.
Okay. Right. So I do think, even on second viewing, I still think Chinatown can be a little bit inaccessible and a bit pleased with itself in some of the scenes. Like, some of the scenes do feel a bit baggy, and I don't think that's just to modern eyes. The scene, it's so stupid. The scene in the library bit is too long. There's a scene where we watch Hollis go down to the beach. And that goes on, it feels like forever, and I don't need to see all of that. I don't really care about who Hollis is. I just want to spend more time with Jack Nicholson. And I have loved LA Confidential deeply for many, many years. But then watching it again, it is, and I suppose it's supposed to be, but it is quite trashy. And it doesn't have the class of Chinatown. And it isn't supposed to, but if we are comparing them. So then let's just take it down to the two things that I like the most, which is Jack Nicholson and Russell Crowe, who are both incendiary in these films. But I think Jack Nicholson edges it, so Chinatown.
Wow.
Interesting.
You're next, Alex.
So, for a start, they're both incredible films. Watching Chinatown for the first time was a real experience. Very, very, very difficult to pick. So, me being me, I've gone for a me reason why I've picked the film that I am picking. Because you all know me. You know what I like, and I do like a happy ending, and I like an ex-hooker in Arizona and Ed Exley getting promoted to King Cop or whatever they call it. I prefer that to Faye done away with a fucking hole in her head. It's not the feel-good ending that I was hoping for after that journey. There are other reasons. I just enjoyed LA Confidential a bit more. It spoke to me a bit more. I like that kind of filmmaking. But really, I like a happy ending after being on a journey like that. So I am picking LA Confidential.
Interesting.
Chris has the deciding vote. He loves it on his goes.
only when I'm sure, and the weeks when I'm not sure, like this week, it's I don't like it as much. Okay, with LA Confidential, I love the economy of storytelling. I don't think there's a wasted moment or line. I love the three protagonists, the journey they go on, like the Wizard of Oz, the way you're constantly having to reassess them. The only negative, I didn't really go into it when we were talking about it, but I think there are a few too many coincidences in the plot in LA Confidential when you sort of take a step back, which is not hugely satisfying. And I thought that the weirdly happy ending doesn't sit right with me. But it should have won Best Picture that year. We didn't say that. It lost to Titanic. Yeah. Should have won. I try and watch them in the right order, of chronological order, and this week I didn't. And so I watched LA Confidential first. And so when I'm watching Chinatown afterwards, the whole time, I was thinking, LA Confidential's got this in the bag. Surprise me. This is not doing it. But then the last 20 minutes of Chinatown happens, and that hit me like a ton of bricks. The opposite of LA Confidential, the non-happy ending, and the futility and the sadness... And it made me remember why that script and those performances are so celebrated. And I knew it had to win. So I've gone for Chinatown because of the ending.
Wow. So you've gone for the movie where the incestuous dad gets to live the rest of his life with his own daughter.
Because I think it's the more believable ending. I think it's the real ending.
Wow. Chinatown is the winner this week. Have we had a few weeks? This is the second week in a row where I've lost.
Do you think of it as a competition?
I certainly do.
I really don't.
Yeah. It is a competition.
Oh, okay.
Between two films, but it's just interesting. But yeah, I'm happy. I'd say it was a close call this week. I just think LA Confidential is more fun. That's how it goes, though, you know?
Let's not end with your opinion. Let's end with what won.
I was coming to that. So Chinatown is the winner this week. Congratulations. All right. Let's look ahead to next week. There was a couple of heavy movies, that was. Victoria, what are you going to do for us next week? Remind us of the clue, first of all, that you gave us on Monday's episode.
The clue was, women, can't live with them, can't look after your kids without them.
Right.
So, I am going to give Chris the hand that rocks the cradle, and okay. Alex, single white female.
All right, cool.
Oh, belters. Nasty.
That's a great combination. All right, great. The hand that rocks the cradle and...
single white female.
Single white female. Those are our movies for next week. So go away, do your homework. And as you're doing your homework, just get on your phones and subscribe to us and rate and review us on any of these sites that you get your podcasts from, Apple, Spotify or other. It is hugely appreciated by us. You can find out more information at ClashPod on Twitter. Oh, we've just got a new Instagram, haven't we, in case we do Instagram.
ClashPod, go to ClashPod on Instagram and hopefully there'll be some fun stories
cool.
pictures and stuff like that.
But also, you know, if you're a traditionalist, you can even email us, show@clashpod.com. So many ways to get in touch. Thank you for listening. Congratulations to Chinatown. Commiserations to LA Confidential. Back on Monday. Bye-bye.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions
over 3 glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.